It's a great pleasure to introduce Don Dayton. I've known him for about 30 years. I'm sure he will forgive me if I say he is one of God's very special irregulars. By that I mean, Martin Marty is his Dr. Vater. And if you think of his writings, he's the editor of, I think it's 48 or something, Don, is that right? 48 of things he has retrieved from the 19th, early 20th century revivalism, the holiness movement. I have about a dozen, or 15 actually, of these, bringing back the life. So you think of him as an historian. But over the 30 years I've known him, whether you speak to theology, he seems to be opening new doors. And I think, now why didn't I think of that? If one talks of the Bible and scriptural studies, the same things happen. And so the breadth. Further, if you have worked on a committee with Don Dayton, with a whole group, he can keep it on track and draw out what really matters as it is. He's written a long paper here, but if you read it, there's a great deal we can learn from it. Don, we are very happy to have you here.
First of all, a couple comments to position myself in this discussion. And I must admit that I'm reeling a bit from the entering this, all this ferment about this event in 57 and trying to find my own way into this, and I'm having a bit of a difficult time. First of all, I think maybe I should say, when Michael asked me to give this paper, my first response was, I don't give papers as an evangelical. And as I got into this discussion, I discovered that my affinities were probably more with the historic Adventists in the discussion, which required, that was an insight that surprised me just a little bit. But we've gone back through this insider, outsider, in-house, outhouse relationship to this, and I guess I'm the outhouse or the outsider participant in this. I was reminded a little bit of a favorite cartoon of mine when one was thinking about Walter Martin and so on. I think it was in Christianity Today, but I may be mistaken. It showed a sort of an Anglican rector wandering around through the graveyard outside his church, reading a book. And if you looked carefully at it, it said The Joy of Sex, S-E-C-T-S. But I guess the problem is in this discussion is really trying to determine which would be the safe sex to be practiced. But sorry about that. But anyway, I apologize for the length of the paper, and I'm not going to try to read it. What I'm going to try to do is to tell you what I was doing. Sometimes I don't always make clear what I'm trying to do. That is, I'm too subtle or something. But at least let me say, try to identify some of those key points so that you'll know what I am trying to do. The paper has a more broad perspective than the focus on the questions on doctrine volume, but it comes down to that at the end. And about halfway through the paper, I begin to deal with my own perspective on the issues that are raised in that volume. While I was preparing this paper, I was surprised that U.S. News and World Report had a cover story on 1957 as the year that changed America. I was surprised. Of course, that's The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss and the Sputnik and a number of other things, but I was struck by that connection as I was writing the paper. I want to be clear that I am claiming no real expertise in Adventist history and theology. On the other hand, I have always been interested in that. This dates in part to the fact that during my nearly 20 years at Northern Baptist Seminary in the western suburbs of Chicago, one of my assignments was to be professor of non-Baptist history and thought. That is, there was a required course in denominational heritage, and my colleague Eric Ullman did all the Baptists and I did everybody else. And among them were students from Aurora College, the Advent Christian College nearby. And then, particularly because we had the largest Hispanic program in the country, there were a large number of Adventists who came to study at Northern because of the Hispanic program. And I actually ended up one term teaching in Spanish Adventist heritage to Latin American Adventists. That led to some very hot arguments because most of them were, I think, identifying more with the evangelical Adventist side, and I was actually being more interested in some of the historic Adventist positions and was arguing that some of the distinctive witnesses of Adventism should not be suppressed in a process of assimilation into the evangelical culture. Those are, again, comments to try to position myself. It's also, I think I should say that I feel intimately intertwined with the Adventist history. And I tell a rather extended story of when I happened across a book of a volume of the Bible Examiner by George Sturz in a bookstore in upstate New York. And I was surprised to discover in that a report of a church trial in which a member of my church, the Wesleyan Methodist Church, was driven out of the church because of his adoption of conditionalist and annihilationist views. And in the course of that trial, in defending himself, Elder John Tate introduced evidence that Orange Scott, the founder of the denomination, had actually become what in that text is called destructionist. I spent yesterday afternoon in the Adventist Research Center collecting the articles from the Bible Examiner, which I didn't have, trying to find more details about this. But I tell that story. I've got some of these stories you may think are kind of irrelevant to the argument of the paper, but they actually are the heart of it in a sense, because I invite you by the telling of that story to reflect on the fact that the Wesleyan Church, which founded Wheaton College, the icon of modern evangelicalism, came within a hair's breadth of becoming either annihilationist or universal restorationist at that period. And anyway, the intertwining of this, Luther Lee, one of the founders of the denomination, wrote a book on the immortality of the soul, which I take as a sign that there was a great deal of ferment around these issues. Now, I tell this story because I think when all this literature that I've been reading, there's a tendency to project back on the 19th century and even on the questions around the questions on doctrine, modern sensitivities about orthodoxy, evangelicals versus fundamentalists and versus modernists and so on, which I think are somewhat anachronistic, and that the period of the formation of Adventism in my church was much more fluid, and there was much more intertwining in that, in a way that I feel I have some investment myself in the theological struggles of Adventism, which is out of the dynamic which has brought me, in a sense, to this discussion. And I love to shock my friends in evangelical circles by reminding them that the evangelical fundamentalist literature has all kinds of stuff that they can't recognize as there because they've suppressed the possibility that it could be there. One of my favorites is to remind evangelicals and fundamentalists that Hannah Whitall Smith, author of The Christian Secret of a Happy Life, perhaps the most widely read devotional book of the fundamentalist evangelical tradition, still passed out by Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson as tokens of appreciation for contributions to their ministries, and that she was a universal restorationist. And most evangelical fundamentalists would be shocked to discover, and it's all there in the literature, books published by Moody Bible Institute carry her argument from her own experience as a mother that God would never finally reject any of God's children. I'm using those stories just to upset the categories and to make you feel uncomfortable with the inherited ways of talking about this, because they don't work a lot. They don't work when you actually get back into the history. Then I use, and this, I'm still trying to sort some of this out. I'm fascinated with this figure, George Sturz, and I wish I knew more about him. I used to have conversations with Jim Penton, who's a Canadian scholar within the Jehovah's Witness movement. He left them by over the justification by faith kinds of issues. And he was going to write a biography of Sturz. And I may have misunderstood and don't remember correctly his conversations, but I had the strong impression that he claimed for the Adventist, for the Jehovah's Witnesses tradition, Sturz. Now, certainly, Sturz was a major influence in the formation of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Whether he actually, as I got the impression, and I may have been mistaken, whether he actually ended up a part of the movement. But I've often reflected on Sturz, because he started out a Congregationalist minister and reflects a lot of the kind of basic American Christianity. He became a sort of violent Methodist abolitionist. He was actually imprisoned for his abolitionist activities, and he was very close to my own denomination, that is the abolitionist Methodists. Then he became a Millerite in, I think, probably the early 40s, and edited this Bible Examiner up until his death about 1880. And then, however one sorts out this period of whether or not he was actually a Jehovah's Witnesses or not. But this seems, by the categories that we bring to the discussion, a completely impossible, oxymoronic pilgrimage. How could one put all that in one life? And as I've reflected on Sturz's pilgrimage, I begin to wonder if one shouldn't turn it on its head and say, what's wrong with our categories that won't let Sturz have this pilgrimage that he has, and that we should give it more integrity and think about it? And as I have thought about that, and this is my, what I'm coming to is, I reject most of the historiography and self-understanding of the evangelical movement of it, its understanding of itself. And I think it has to be completely revised. And George Sturz prompts me to pose the question whether we shouldn't reverse the discussion and say that fundamentalism is a movement like Adventism, not the other way around, or try to find the other way of doing this. That is, to argue that in some sense, the fundamentalist movement, the Adventist movement, and the Jehovah's Witnesses all belong to the same family of Christian movements. That is, they are all, in a sense, radically eschatological, somewhat sectarian, remnant kinds of theologies, and so on. Now, I began to play with these ideas about 20 years ago or so, 30 years ago, and this is too wild to think that way. But the more I've lived with it, the more I've had to move more and more in that direction. I've spent a lot of time in Latin America, where if you read the Catholic literature, it's the same stuff. It's all that stuff over there. It's all that people that want to disrupt, thank you very much, disrupt the sort of inherited unity of Catholic culture and the social order and the church and the social order, and that these are all disruptive movements that come in and destroy our Christian culture. And as I've gotten into the last quarter of a century, I've been involved in as a member of the Commission of the Faith and Order Commission of the National Council of Churches. And there, in that discussion, I've had to abandon a lot of my preconceived conceptions about what constitutes liberal and conservative and so on in that, because in many ways it is the World Council and the National Council that are the conservatives in the face of radicals who are calling into question that classical Christian position that's been expressed there. And I've come to the conclusion that it's really eschatology that shapes the conflict between mainline and evangelical traditions. And most interesting recent illustration of this is that the National Association of Evangelicals is engaged in horrendous controversies right now over whether environmentalism, to put that on the agenda, is the result of liberal influence. Well, I think that's poppycock. The real issue is the eschatology, that is, whether this world has a role in the next world, or whether this world is being abandoned. And the issue is really about eschatology. Well, if you begin to reflect on those kinds of questions, I've concluded that you have to tell the story of fundamentalism and the fundamentalist modernist controversies, not as a conservative liberal fight, but as a fight over the rise of dispensational premillennialism. And I've got about several pages of a kind of outline argument of that case. And let me just outline what I'm doing there rather than reading the whole thing. I should say that what I'm doing in this is sort of reasserting the thesis of Ernst Sandin, who went to Wheaton College and then spent the rest of his life, prematurely shortened by cancer, trying to figure out what he'd experienced theologically at Wheaton College. And he argued in a book, The Roots of Fundamentalism, that it was essentially the late stages of dispensational premillennialism that he'd experienced, and that more could be explained in terms of that than anything else. Now, that thesis is despised by the neo-evangelical interpreters of evangelical fundamentalist tradition, because it implies that they are not the carriers of the Orthodox tradition in Christianity, but don't exist before the 19th century and are the carriers of this particularly eschatologically focused sets of questions. Now, I'm going to be interested in Ken's response to this crack that I make in the paper. I've always puzzled over this kind of cottage industry of the refutation of the sects and cults. And I've decided you don't have that in a lot of the mainstream Christianity in quite the same way. I think that cottage industry is in part that it's your near neighbors that you have to refute. It's not the people that are at a distance, it's the near neighbors. And so what you have in that is an in-house fight between varieties of eschatological movements out of the 19th century. And that you could make a lot more sense of some of that, or you can make some sense of things that you can't explain otherwise if you attend to that. Well, anyway, just to indicate, I began to toy with these ideas in my book, Discovering an Evangelical Heritage, where that book is the story of my recovery of the radical social tradition that characterized early Wheaton College, and puzzling over what happened to it in the 20th century. And eschatology is the best explanation I can come up with, because the early stage of Wheaton was radically postmillennial, and that the social witness and transformation was a part of the inauguration of the millennium. When that didn't work, and the bottom dropped out of that vision, they turned to a dispensational premillennialism in the late 19th century. And that whole great reversal can, I think, only be explained in terms of the eschatology. So that begins to point. I was a little bit stunned to discover in my own tradition a book called Postmillennialism and the Higher Critics, which argues that these are people in the Southern Holiness movement who had become converted to dispensationalism, and they're arguing that the issue is not so much conservative liberal, the rise of biblical criticism. The issue is that the forms of criticism, biblical criticism being practiced, they thought depended on post-millennial theology. Now that's an interesting case to make, but they were making it quite strongly. And it's worth noting that the word fundamentalist itself was coined by Curtis Lee Laws, the editor of the Watchman Examiner in the Baptist tradition, precisely to avoid the label premillennialist, which was being thrown at them by the University of Chicago types objecting to the fundamentalist movement. And so fundamentalism was, the label itself came out of the eschatological fights and was an effort to say, no, we want to be, we think we're Orthodox, and the people at University of Chicago are saying, well, no, you're not. And the issue, it was the middle of World War I, which was very interesting, was that the University of Chicago people were concerned that the fundamentalists, because they believed that all the empires of the world would fade and had feet of clay and following the Book of Daniel and so on, that fundamentalism was subversive to the patriotism demanded by World War I, and if you held that position, you wouldn't have the moral strength to resist Germany because you didn't really believe in the superiority of Western civilization in a kind of post-millennial kind of way. So that the issues, again, you can get more illumination I do this through ecumenism. The resolutions of the First Baptist Church in New York adopted a resolution against the interchurch world movement in World War I, because it was post-millennial in all its tendencies. That is, the issue was whether to rebuild the infrastructure of Europe, and in the premillennial vision, you didn't need to. But in the sort of world-affirming post-millennial vision, it was worth rebuilding the roads in Germany and so on. So that the division between the sort of ecumenical movement and the fundamentalist evangelical movement was shaped again by eschatology. I've got two or three pages where I argue that the same thing is true of the issue of the rise of creationism and the attack on Darwin, and that I give several illustrations of how how the eschatology really shapes the rejection of Darwin. The issue was finally progress toward versus decline, and there's a very famous essay which Ron Numbers leaves out of his 10 volumes source material of creationist literature, Daniel versus Darwin, written by W.B. Reilly, the famous Baptist fundamentalist. Well, anyway, the point of all that is that you cannot understand the fundamentalist evangelical tradition in a kind of conservative liberal paradigm as the Orthodox tradition. It was not generic orthodoxy. It was a very specific theology, and it was a theology that does strange things. It creates, in one sense, the category of modernism. That is, many people that we think of as classical Christians and Protestants and so on actually become modernists when viewed through this grid. I give the illustration to John Wesley, and about halfway through the paper I have this long quotation, which you can identify in your version, which describes W.B. Reilly's distinction between fundamentalists and modernists, and it is not a question of generic orthodoxy or liberalism versus orthodoxy. It is a question of a specific theology generated by the eschatology, so that, for example, the fundamentalists did not believe in following the Sermon on the Mount because that was to be identified with the millennium. And so anybody that preaches the Sermon on the Mount is by definition a modernist, which makes John Wesley a modernist par excellence in this. So I think to get into a lot of this, one has to completely reorient one's thinking, and one has to be very skeptical about most of our assumptions about what the nature of fundamentalism and evangelicalism are, which made it very difficult for me as I got into reading the questions on doctrine and the literature afterwards, because everybody in the book and later seems to accept assumptions about the nature of fundamentalism and evangelicalism that I find fundamentally puzzling. Well, anyway, I tell a story in there of a friend of mine in college who became an Anglican, and my father, who was president of the college at a later stage, said, "Poor David, he had such a wonderful background, but now he's gone liberal. He's become an Episcopal priest." And I said to my father, no, he's gone conservative. Out of his love for the creeds of the church, the classical tradition, the Book of the Common Prayer, and so on, he has left a radical position and trying to find his way back into the center of Christianity. And I said, your categories won't explain, David. Well, now the point is that my church, like the Adventist, falls in to a certain extent in the categories of a more sectarian, marginal movement in the history of Christianity. And it's characteristic of these movements that they spin out and then try to find their way back in the next two or three generations. And the sociology becomes very, very determinative. I'll give a couple of illustrations from my church. My church began in 1850s to ordain women. By the 1950s, it had largely forgotten that it had ever done this and would have been horrified by the suggestion that it should do such. And that was just the time in which women were demanding roles in ministry. But the main line did not learn it from my church. They learned it from somewhere else. Similar about the social witness. The same thing is true of Pentecostalism. Early Pentecostalism is infinitely more interesting to me theologically than late-stage evangelicalized Pentecostalism, because I find more helpful suggestions in early Pentecostalism. But I don't learn this from the Pentecostals. I learn this from Harvard and Yale professors who are coming around after a century to teach what the Pentecostals were teaching in their early years. And I sometimes wonder if the same is not true of the Adventist experience. And I think one must interpret the book, Questions on Doctrine and so on, as in a larger trajectory of moving out and then at least some people trying to find their way back in to more classical positions. And I find early Adventist theology more interesting than later evangelicalized Adventist theology. I think that's true to a certain extent of the conditionalism. I began to read and study conditionalism, and Oscar Kuhlmann, New Testament scholar from Basel, I didn't learn it from Adventists. One could go on with other illustrations of this, but here I turn in the paper, and I'll just identify some of the things I'm trying to do. I pick up the issues which George Knight identifies as the four crucial fundamental issues in the Questions on Doctrine, and I pick up especially the question of the incarnation and whether or not the incarnation involved the assumption of sinful human nature. Now, I don't share either the sense that fundamentalist evangelical tradition should be the measure of orthodoxy, nor do I share the horror of that tradition of the idea of the assumption of sinful human nature. I've been trying to figure out why I don't share that horror that a lot of people seem to have. I know one reason I don't is because I've been deeply influenced by the theology of Karl Barth, who asserted this position in his own theology. And in the late 20th century, there was a major revival of this doctrine that the incarnation involved the assumption of sinful human nature. Again, we didn't learn it from the Adventist, we're learning it from Barth. That's an interesting dynamic because most of the Adventists are trying to get out from under that doctrine and to reassimilate under the pressure from the evangelical fundamentalist into a tradition which I think is less interesting.
George Henry, Princeton theologian,
very close to that. Yes, I mentioned Henry in a couple pages, and there are a lot of interesting theological issues at stake in this. I won't have time to go on with them, but since Barth, we've seen this in in Thomas Aquinas, we've been reminded that the early church had a slogan that whatever is not assumed is not redeemed, and that there was something of the assumption of this. Now, this has partly been carried more in the Eastern traditions than in the Western traditions, which have become more atonement-centered in the sense of Good Friday-centered, rather than incorporating these larger themes. I think it would be interesting to study one of the fascinating figures that I think of in the 19th century, that is, Edward Irving got in trouble with the Reformed tradition over this position. And in his thought, it was associated with the question, he was also declared heretical over this, and the related question that he asserted that Christ was dependent on the Holy Spirit in the same way that we are, and that some people have a Christology which makes them very nervous about facts reported in the New Testament that Jesus prayed or Jesus struggled or Jesus prayed for help or was in the desert and so on like this, because their sense of the divinity of Christ precludes them from taking seriously the New Testament stories that about Jesus and what he said and did. Well, anyway, I have a section in which I talk about the problems in which the Calvinist tradition in general has with a much more realistic concept of Christ, and I point at some of the philosophical and theological roots behind this. That is, the Calvinist tradition is very nervous. It has a slogan that the human cannot become the carrier of the divine. So it gets very nervous about Wesleyan and Eastern and other kinds of traditions. It has another slogan, which it rejects the Lutheran tradition, that there can't be any inner penetration of the human and the divine, which gets very close to these issues. Well, anyway, there are some classical roots to these kinds of questions, but I think, I'm going to make just a couple more comments and as a way of wrapping up the latter part of the discussion, which you can read. I think the issues go very, very deeply. I was astounded to pick up recently a copy of the Cambridge Companion to Evangelical Theology. And it represents a kind of stream of evangelicalism which has moved itself back to embrace classical orthodoxy. And Kevin Van Hooser, who's now at Trinity Seminary, argues in there that the classical Orthodox tradition is a fusion of biblical and Greek metaphysical thinking. And so he self-consciously defends that hybrid as the essence of evangelical Christianity. And I myself have grown increasingly sympathetic to the sort of open theism traditions. Rick Rice, who's here with us, has been the Adventist participant in that with Clark Pinnock, although I get very angry at the evangelical publishers who will publish his articles in the book, but they will not mention that he is an Adventist for fear it will discredit the work. But at any rate, one could make a case that partly that the larger structure of Adventist theology was to break out of Greek metaphysical presuppositions. And one can see that clearly on the question of the immortality of the soul. I think it also affects this discussion of incarnation and in profound sorts of ways. And one might even argue that I think the larger question that Adventism raises, at least for me, is the question of the status of the Old Testament within Christian theology. And I think ecumenical 4th century consensus suppressed the Jewish elements, and that Adventism is a representation of a protest against that, the Sabbath, works, law, etc., etc. And one of my problems with the Walter Wright tradition of the refutation sects and cults is that I'm committed to understanding these movements as testimonies to cracks in the classical Christian tradition that we need to listen to very carefully to find out where those cracks are, and that they should lead to the revising of the inherited tradition, and that that should develop a different agenda for Adventism than the assimilation into the evangelical tradition. It should provide the basis from which to rethink some very fundamental and very basic questions that we are coming to stumbling toward, but in many ways Adventism could be seen as a carrier of those questions, and it needs to be mining its own sources and helping us all to find our way, constructive theology for the whole church. Now, I've skipped over in getting to my conclusion a long section which I think is maybe one of my more important contributions, in which I talk about the whole Desmond Ford and stuff like this, and that it's part of my conviction that Methodism was the strongest theological force in the years of the formation of Adventism, and that one must interpret Adventism against the backdrop of the Methodist tradition. And I expound the Methodist tradition and Wesley's struggle with Luther to show that most of the characteristic moves that were made in Adventism on the law, justification, so on, were made already in the Methodist tradition, and that one should interpret, say, the Desmond Ford controversies and so on, where the question of what did it mean to continue the Reformation, that whether that is to return to a Lutheran tradition, as I see going on in some of the questions on doctrine controversies, or whether that means to extend the principles of the Reformation and to move beyond doctrine and justification into sanctification and so on. And I think the Wesleyan tradition, Pietism, Adventism, all need to be interpreted in that, in the sense of adding sanctification to justification, or recovering that stream. And so most of the features of Adventism that I most value are the ones that are most under threat in many of these discussions around the shaking of Adventism. Well, anyway, those are maybe somewhat random. You can maybe see the coherence more if you read the whole paper. But I've had an interesting 3 months or so writing this paper, struggling over it. Do I really want to say that, or do I want to say this or not? But I hope you find the paper of some value and making some contribution to your discussions. Thank you very much.